Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by John Rawling and Ian Dark. This week we are talking about trainers and some of the great hardmen coaches of the day, or of the game, should I say. And John, we started with Ian last time, so let me start with you this time. What makes a good trainer? Because they need to tick an awful lot of boxes to be good in this game.
Well, I think it's fairly simple and it's a short answer, really. It's a man who can get the most out of the bloke who's working with him. It's the ability to motivate, to understand them, to empathise, as you like. Tactics come into it to a degree, but I think the biggest thing is to recognise the attributes of the boxer, of the fighter you've got, and bring the most out of them.
Ian, I mean, these are the thing is, we know, and obviously there's hundreds of trainers around the world that do have these relationships with their fighters, and they are mentors, they're father figures, they're big brothers, they're coaches, you know, they're counsellors. They play a vital role in the life of a fighter, don't they?
Yeah, and I think there's got to be an empathy. It can't be like the Mickey Duff, Lloyd Hunnigan thing between a trainer and a fighter. It may be between a manager and a fighter, you know, where he said, you know, there's nothing in the contract that says we have to like each other. I think a fighter and a trainer do have to like each other a little bit for it to work. There is a psychological element to it, but you've got to be really at the very top level. You've got to be a master reader of a fight, haven't you? You've got to be someone who knows exactly what's going on and can react quickly within a fight, maybe to change strategy, to know the right thing to say, to have the clarity to get the ideas over. And I think if you haven't got that, it's going to be a struggle at the very top level. I mean, you asked John there, what makes a great trainer? I can tell you some of the things that makes a bad trainer. A trainer who's too brave, leaves his fighter out there when he hasn't got a hope of winning, and all he's doing is accruing damage and lessening his chances for the rest of his career. Somebody who's a bit delusional, who doesn't understand the game, and somebody who doesn't really know what's happening in a fight. I'm not going to embarrass the trainer I've got in mind here, but it was a world title fight. His guy was a mile behind on points. He needed a knockout in the last round, and he was a bit of a puncher. And the advice from the corner man, the trainer, was go out and keep him on the end of your jab. Keeping him under the jab wasn't going to win the fight. He needed something spectacular. So there are some bad ones around, but of course there have been many, many great ones.
And then, John, I suppose we'll get into some specifics as we go on, but let me ask you this about while we're at the top. Some dads have done better jobs than others, and there are some people who think that fathers shouldn't be in the corner of fighters anymore. Obviously, there are some success stories, but then there's been some bitter fallouts and all the rest of it. What's your stance on fathers in the corner?
Well, nobody knows the fighter better than the father, you could argue. I mean, I think that the great example in British boxing has to be Enzo Calzaghe, who had Joe. He had all sorts of criticism through his career. People saying, "Oh, he's naive tactically. He can't hold pads properly. He doesn't work him. He doesn't bind hands properly. Therefore, he gets." Broken hands. You know, Joe said about it, that is crap. He said, people who say that don't understand. He has a way to communicate with me and say things to me that no other trainer possibly could do. He had an ability to communicate and get the most out of him. I think basically Joe, by his own admission, was a bit of a lazy sod who needed a kick up the arse. And Enzo was the best man to do that. And I was actually, you know, with a view to doing this today, I was speaking to Enzo Macronelli this morning, who was part of that South Wales group that Enzo Calzaghe had. And I said, what made him special? He said, what made him special was that he would put up with no shit. He got in your head and got that little bit more out of you. And he told me one little example of a time when Joe was working with him and he'd had a particularly lethargic and poor pad session and workout. And he said to him, in front of everybody else, basically to humiliate Joe, call yourself a champion, you're more like a fucking chump, you know. And that was Enzo, and he's speaking this amazing accent, which you'd remember and Ian had remember, you know. He's half Italian, half British, and half the time I don't think the fighters knew what the hell he was talking about. But his sheer enthusiasm and the fact he was an absolute disciplinarian actually put together a remarkable group of fighters. You know, there's Joe, Enzo Macronelli, Gavin Rees, Nathan Cleverley, Gary Lockett, Bradley Price. There were some really good fighters down there, and Enzo, who got awards in the end over in America as Trainer of the Year, you know, I think Enzo finally got the accolades that he'd long deserved.
Yeah, but do you think he might be the exception that proves the rule? I mean, there have been other successful father-son relationships, but I would say that would be in the minority. I think there would be a problem really having a father in the corner, because maybe, you know, there's that slight kind of wild disrespect that goes on between the son and the father sometimes, like, I'm not going to take any notice of the old man, or the father looks after his son too much, you know, maybe pulls him out of a fight before his time. So you've seen it go wrong a fair few times as well.
Yeah, I mean, Richie Woodall always says to me, talking about his father, who trained him, of course, and he said that it was his dad who actually said to him, after he'd lost to Joe Calzaghe in whatever year it was, he said to him, it's over, son. He said, you're not doing what you once could. I think it's tight, and you're getting caught. It's time to go. So, you know, that was another example of a father who took his son all the way to a world title and also was compassionate enough to say, it's time to quit.
It was great, actually. I mean, those two were wonderful, weren't they, together? Richie, I love Richie. You know, he'd talk about West Brom all day to you, and you'd go in there. It's the only gym I ever went inside where they were playing George Formby records. I mean, it's just something else.
And good old Len, you know, you talk about them being big West Brom fans. Len used to run the press room at the Hawthorns. So you go there and, you know, you're ready to sign in and get your bits and bats. And it was old Len who was there. You all right, John? All right?
Yeah.
lovely old boy he was.
Yeah, fantastic. Really, really, really good. But, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, about sit down, son, basically. That kind of alludes, doesn't it, to probably the greatest trainer's decision in the corner ever taken in the Thriller in Manila with Eddie Futch. So, you know, saying those, well, they are immortal words in boxing terms, aren't they? To Joe Frazier, sit down, son, but nobody's ever going to forget what you did here today. Nobody ever has. That has to be the most wise and compassionate decision probably any trainer ever took in the corner, to look after his guy before, well, who knows what would have happened to him in the last round. And of course, I think Joe Frazier didn't talk to Eddie, did you, for about a year after that, but probably in later life he did see the wisdom of it.
I think Eddie Futch, Triz, has to go down as one of the greats, doesn't he? I mean, as a young man, he was a decent little fighter himself. Very small, Eddie was, and he used to spar Joe Lewis back in the day. Joe used to use him for speed work, used to sharpen him up, but he acquired so much knowledge, and he was one of those who, I don't really remember Eddie ever remotely losing his rag. He was one of those very level characters who was just, I mean, he was lovely, really, wasn't he? And he was great.
He was calm. And, of course, he trained four of the five men to beat Muhammad Ali, didn't he? Frazier, Norton, Holmes, well, Burbick. You can't count Burbick at the end because it was the last Ali fight. But, you know, Yeah, tremendous knowledge. And you said it, John, that extreme calm that he had at all times, even amid the fury and fire of a big fight.
Well, do you know what, yes, as well? So some of these trainers, you can tell how good they are because they pass down to future generations. Obviously, one of Eddie Futch's fighters was Freddie Roach, who's now gone on to become a Hall of Fame trainer in his own right. And Wayne McCulloch, who's training fighters, including Jamel Herron out in Las Vegas now. So Eddie Futch's trainers became trainers. And in some ways, I mean, making a segue here, it's the same thing with Emmanuel Stewart in Detroit. And when you look at his fighters, Joey Gamache, Andy Lee, Jonathan Banks, countless guys from the Kronk have gone on to become Sugar Hill. You know, he's created a whole landscape of trainers too, and that's something that Eddie's done. Sorry, John, I just cut you off then.
No, I was since you've mentioned Manny there, Emmanuel Stewart. I mean, he was cut of the same cloth, wasn't he? The Kronk gym, which I assume you went to, I went, and Ian would have gone as well. You know, the bear pit atmosphere of that basement in that little council owned property in Detroit was extraordinary. And there were some very, very hard men in there, and there used to be ring wars in sparring. But yeah, Emmanuel was so calm and collected, composed, wasn't he? And he was one of those people who, as a non-fighter, if you like, we're observers, aren't we? We're coming at it from a different angle. We're coming at it from outside. Emmanuel would always take the time to sensibly consider your question, and he'd sometimes even ask you, you know, what do you think? He was one of those people you got the impression he was patient, he was ready to explain to anybody who
asked
him.
He never asked me, John. He never asked me. I think he'd heard my commentaries. He never asked me. He was always very friendly, though, wasn't he? He'd had a kind of mischievous way about him, and he was a fast talker, and he could just see every fight, and his knowledge of the business was he could analyze any fight in about three sentences. It seemed he was that good at doing it. I mean, do you remember that, talking about those trips to the Kronk gym? I mean, it was set in a really, really kind of rough area with grills around and burnt out houses. I remember doing a piece to camera for Sky outside the gym one day, and these guys standing alongside us watching you do it said, "You're not going to stand there for long, are you?" I said, "Why not?" I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "We're outside the gym. Somebody will take a pop shot at you from one of these tower blocks, you know, nearby." I said, "Will they?" He said, "Yeah, get out of here." I said, you're a guy in a suit with a tie on, you know, doing TV. I said, you're a natural target. So I said to the cameraman, "Let's get out of here."
There's another thing I remember about going to that gym as well. There was, as you say, it was so rough around there. It was a fairly scary neighborhood, to put it mildly, with burned out houses and wrecked cars and God knows what. And outside the gym was this absolutely immaculate red with cream top and cream leather Rolls Royce Corniche. And yeah, I said, "Whose is that?" They said, "Do you need to ask? It's Emmanuel's."
Yeah, and nobody touched his car. That was like Eric Morales, wasn't it? In, I think it was Tijuana, wasn't it? I mean, he used to leave his car hanging around, you know, with the keys in. Nobody went near. Nobody went. They knew better. Yeah, I mean, that was his respect. Because Diana Ross used to live right near that gym, didn't she, when she grew up near that gym?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So, by the way, guys, Emmanuel was always very good to me, and so was Angelo Dundee. I think being British in many ways did help open doors for us, hasn't it? It has in the past.
Yeah. Well, do you remember when Boxing News got into trouble? It was something that Harry Mullen had written about Barry McGuigan and Barney Eastwood, and Barney was suing Boxing News, and there was a very real possibility that the paper was going to go to the wall, that he was going to put it out of business. And Emmanuel jumped on a plane. They did a dinner, a fundraising dinner, and he came across from Detroit and spoke at the dinner. and asked for nothing. He took no money, and that was, I think, a measure of just how much he thought of the British fight fans and the British media and the British publication Boxing News.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing you've got to think about, Stuart, you know, he used to be an electrician, didn't he? And then he came into the business, learned the trade. But imagine what he did with you know, Thomas the Hitman Hearns. Hearns was a light-hitting amateur. I think he only had about 8 knockouts and 155 amateur bouts, and he turned him into one of the most devastating punchers, you know, in boxing history. So that was an incredible thing. And then everything he did with Vladimir Klitschko and knocked out the folks in him, knocked out the folks in Lennox as well, didn't he, too? So, you know, I don't know how many world champions it was he had, but, you know, everybody really, or anybody with any sense, never had much hesitation in hiring him.
No, well, obviously, there was that period where he was, and I think it wasn't said in a particularly pleasant term, but I mean it is what it is. I don't think it was particularly unsavory early either, but people called him a hired gun. But he would show up with Naz, with Oscar De La Hoya, with Chavez, and he would have turns in the corner with all these guys because they knew that he was a safe pair of hands, I guess, and that's what happens.
Holyfield for a while, Aaron Pryor. It's incredible. I mean, I've just looked it up here. 41 world champions passed through his hand at one time or another.
Staggering. And I mean, I said about Angelo Dundee there as well. So Ian, I suppose with one of your early trips, well, he opened a door for you for Ali, but I always remember phoning at Angelo, but this was obviously in the days before cell phones. And I remember he was getting up there in age then and I couldn't get him off the phone. And I was just a cub reporter and he would just talk my ears off. I mean, I wish I'd had all those conversations taped and backed up because, you know, he would just end. I remember when Matt Christie just joined Boxing News, we were preparing for the eventual passing of the greatest. And I said to him, you know, I haven't got time to speak to Angelo, which now sounds absolutely stupid, but can you do it for us? And it was one of Matt's first assignments. I gave him Angelo's number. And I think he wound up with about 5 or 6,000 word monologue from Angelo Dundee, which ran in the thing when Muhammad eventually passed. We sat on it for years because Ali stayed with us. But you know, Angelo was so good with his time and so generous; it was unbelievable.
He could talk all day, Angelo, about his fighters, and you could listen to him all day as well. I remember doing Sugar Ray Leonard Thomas Hearns, the first fight, you know, when he came out with that line after a few rounds when Hearns was dominating early and said to Leonard, "You're blowing it, kid." And that was kind of all it needed, really. And I remembered something when I was watching that fight that he said in the build-up to it. He said to the media guys, you keep telling me what a big puncher Tommy Hearns is. He is a big puncher, but here's something. You're going to find out that my guy's the puncher in this fight. Well, look what happened.
Yeah. I remember sitting down with him when he was around. I can't quite remember what the connection was, but he was there when Lennox Lewis fought Mike Tyson in Memphis. And I remember sitting down with him there, and the same thing, Ian. You know, he just went. It was just a delight. We did this piece for I think it was for the old Sport on 4 program on BBC Radio or something, and I'd got hours of this stuff. You know, and they're looking for about 6 minutes, and it's where do you start to edit this down, and where do you find the best bit? Because he wasn't just rambling around incoherently; it was all absolute gold dust that he was coming out with. He was wonderful. His recall of people, of details, of places, and of history was just incredible. And he's one of those people who I'm so glad I had the opportunity to meet him.
The only rap against him, I think, and you've got to include this in any full analysis, is the night of the Ali Holmes fight. Angelo Dundee should have pulled Muhammad out of that fight sooner than he did. But you know something, Bundini Brown was a lot to blame for that, because they kept believing that Ali pulled off so many miracles that he'd pull off another one that night. But Angelo must have known early, I think.
I asked him about that. I asked him that question, and it was a difficult question to ask because you're talking about somebody who was a training legend, about arguably the greatest fighter of all time. You know, why did you allow him to get hurt? And his answer was basically nobody could ever tell Muhammad Ali what to do. You know, yeah. There was nobody who could tell him, you do this, you do that. At the end of the day, he made his own decisions. I think from my perspective, looking at it, I think Angelo probably thought, well, he's going to do this anyway. So if there's going to be somebody alongside him, it might as well be me.
I think, too, to be fair to Angelo about that and what you've just said, John, that's what made him a brilliant trainer of Muhammad Ali, given his very special personality, because sometimes the right thing to do almost is nothing, isn't it? So he left Muhammad Ali. He knew he had a bit of a genius on his hand, and he didn't try to overmeddle in that.
Not a bad CV, that, is it? Having Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard as two of your star students. By the way, Ian, obviously you kicked things off in 1980-ish with Ali and Holmes and going out there. Over here at that time, Terry Lawless was big news. Did you get to know Terry very well? I mean, I've just done a podcast of Boxing Life Stories with Charlie Magri, who had an infamous fallout with Lawless that still burns Charlie a little today. But did you know Lawless well?
Very well, very well. In fact, you know, that's where I kind of came in on the British scene, because at that time, of course, you know, it was Terry Lawless and Mickey Duff and Jarvis Astaire, Mike Barrett. So I was always really going down at one, for one reason or another, to the Royal Oak Gym in Canning Town, you know, and I got to know most of the people around the gym, you know, Maurice Hope and Charlie Magri, you mentioned there, you know, later Jim Watt. They revitalized Jim's career. Jim would never, he says it himself, he'd have never been world lightweight champion if he hadn't got a phone call from Terry Lawless one day saying, you know what, we think we could do a lot with you. Why don't you come and sign with us? You know, Jim did. You know, John H. Stracy, the amazing win in Napolis. So away from home in Mexico as well. They got, you know, they got Napolis at the right time, but great win for Stracy. Bruno, Kayla, all those fighters around that. Hunnigan at the start of his career, and on it goes. Of course, the big rap against Terry was, you know, and Mickey Duff said this many, many times, that he kind of fell in love with his fighters. And when they were doing the matchmaking for them, he'd always want people who would be okay defensively, but not too much attack, you know. So he wanted to carefully nurture those fighters through. But, you know, in the end, he did take them through. You know, there was, I mean, he invited me one day. Do you remember the Sunday Times did a piece, Nick Pitt, at the time, about the cartel, which was dominating British boxing, and saying there was a conflict of interest for Terry Lawless, of course, because if he was on the kind of promotional side as well and part of that deal, how could he be doing the best deal for his fighters? So, which was a valid question, of course. I got a phone call from Terry Lawless who said, meet me, I'm going to bring all the books along. I'll show you all the books. And he met me in this little Italian restaurant in Hornchurch, where he used to live in Essex, and spent the whole meal showing me what he'd paid or the money he hadn't taken from all the fighters he went to. He said, look, I never take anything from them until they get to a certain level. He said, you know, he was absolutely distraught that there would be an accusation against him that he'd somehow ripped off his boxers. And he loved them all. He probably loved them too much. But, you know, you've got to put him down right up there in the list of best British trainers for sure.
And he had other people working with him as well, didn't he? And I mean, he got Jimmy Tibbs working in that Canning Town gym. He'd got, you know, Frank Black, George Francis, who he was another man who worked the corners for him. And, you know, despite the fact that there'd been that the cartel, and the fact that Frank Warren had come along and effectively broken that with the backing of ITV, Frank once told me that when Joe Calzaghe decided he no longer wanted to fight as a Warren fighter and was going to go and take, I think it was the Roy Jones Jr. fight of his own volition, the man who rang Frank up and said, I think this is disgusting, was, and I think Frank was quite shocked by that, but it was Terry Lawless.
Who, of course, was among his big rivals, you know, around that time in the early 80s when take on the boxing establishment of which Terry was a part.
So, John, you mentioned George Francis. Did you get to know George well at all?
Yeah, I did a little. I mean, I knew him well at the end of his career. I didn't know him at the time when he had John Conti. He was one of the first guys who really championed immigrant black boxers. Lenny Gibbs was a fellow who came to St. Pancras Gym, and a friend of Lenny Gibbs was Bunny Sterling, who went on to become a British and European middleweight champion. And George, you know, worked with Bunny, with John Conti, famously Cornelius Boza Edwards, John McGarvey. And then at the end of his career, of course, he got very close to Frank Bruno and took him to the world title at Wembley in 1995. He was a complex character, George, and tragically, he wound up ending his life by suicide at the age of 73. And that was so sad, because I think a lot of people within British boxing thought a great deal of the man. He was a fantastically well-conditioned individual himself, and he prided himself on getting his fighters at all times into amazing shape. Some people have said he was a conditioner rather than a tactician, and there might be an element of truth in that, but my goodness, he really could train those guys.
And he must have done a good psychological job on Frank Bruno, because for Frank to win it at the world heavyweight title at the fourth attempt, I think by then there was a bit of a block in Frank's mind that it was never going to happen. So he did get it right, didn't he, that night against Oliver McCall. So that is a real claim to fame. Yeah, I remember that about him, John. You're right. He was always in, he seemed to be in better shape than his own fighters, didn't he, George? He was incredible.
Hey, by the way, don't forget, George was the guy who had his fighters leaping into the lake at Hampstead Heath, wasn't it? You know, he'd have these guys, Conti, Sterling and Frank, breaking the ice in the lake.
And he said, if you don't do it, I'm not going to buy you breakfast.
You mentioned Cornelius Boza Edwards there. There's a name. I mean, he's in all those great fights, wasn't he? And on the other side of the, you know, he wasn't a big name really in Britain, but made his name, became a headliner almost, didn't he, in the USA.
He's now part of the Mayweather setup in Las Vegas.
Mm.
But yeah, so I mean, in terms of that, by the way, George was unconventional. I mean, people look at ice baths and everything now, but George in some ways was ahead of his time, getting guys to strip down and jump in the lake. But there must have been some more eccentric methods that you guys have seen and heard of over the years. I mean, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. It's always hard when you put someone on the spot like that, but I'm just trying to think. I know the Billy Schwer and his father had the old tennis ball trick, didn't they?
Yeah. I remember Frank, well, I think it was a publicity gimmick, that Terry Lawless rang me one day and said, you know, go down to this dance studio. I'm taking Frank to a dance studio and he's going to learn tap dancing with Roy Castle to improve his his footwork. So, I mean, it made a great feature, but I was pretty sure it was just another kind of thing to get Frank name out there, which they did, of course, amazingly well. But you know, they didn't need a lot of help because he was on Sports Night every Wednesday night, almost every other Wednesday, knocking out casino guards from Carson City. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, talking of the eccentric, I mean, Chris Eubank Senior was eccentric, but he had this wonderful relationship with Ronnie Davis, didn't he? Which, talk about, you could get some mileage out of that. Like, you can still talk about it now with real fondness, right, John?
Oh, you could do a program on that. The two guys loved each other. He used to refer to him as Porter.
My bags, Porter. Please get my bags, Porter.
And Ronnie told me that he'd ring him at all hours of day and night. And if he wasn't there, you know, if he didn't pick the phone up, there was hell to pay. He expected Ronnie to be there as confidant and gopher and trainer at whatever time of the day Chris decided to speak to him. But they were brilliant together. They were so much fun. And I always sort of suggested when I was doing the fights that some of the hardest punches that Chris Eubank ever took were from Ronnie Davis in the corner. Yes. I've seen him slap him across the face harder than you would think was possible.
Yeah, he would have been one of the better opponents on the world tour. Yeah.
What kind of porter was he exactly? Now, I mean, Ronnie, I mean, we all loved Ronnie because, you know, he put up with everything that Eubank was around that time and laughed it all off. But John's right. The chemistry between them was unique in a way. And I mean, fantastic that he got the tune. And of course, he knew too, he was onto a bit of a gold mine with Chris Eubank because his cut of the money for as a trainer, where else was he going to make that? So he looked after that. And that was a really, really good little setup down in Brighton. Or no, let me get it right, Hove. I was always corrected by Chris Eubank every time I said Brighton. He says, I'm from Hove.
By the way, when we talk about dynasties, it'd be remiss of me not to mention Phil Martin and the impact he had in Manchester. And obviously now that's being felt today with people like Maurice Corr, Joe Gallagher, and obviously Billy Graham, who followed Phil. I mean, John, did you have much work with Phil over the years?
Well, I did. I didn't. I'd be fibbing if I said that I knew him well, because I didn't. I knew some of his fighters well and came to know them a lot better. I mean, the great tragedy of Phil Martin was that he put this gym together in a pretty much a wrecked old building down in the Hume area of Manchester, on the south side of Manchester, and the Champs Gym, which became the Phil Martin Boxing Centre or whatever. I mean, the tragedy was that he had these fighters. He had four British champions there at one time, and they were kids who came off the street. He did an extraordinary amount for that community. And the awful tragedy was that he was dead at 44. You know, I mean, he could still have been an impact and a dominant figure in British boxing for decades to come. And it's lovely in a way that Joe Gallagher, Billy Graham, you know, Maurice Corr, these people have actually been able to carry the torch on from what he started, and a very real important contribution that he made to inner city Manchester.
Yeah, and Joe is actually Graham. Back in the same building now as well. Joe's actually training fighters back in Champs Camp.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was at university in Manchester, so I know all about how rough that side of Manchester was. And when the riots were there in 1981 or whenever it was, you know, I mean, Manchester got it as badly as anywhere, and it needed strong people in touch with the community to actually rebuild something for inner city young kids. And Phil Martin did that. He was a very important person in the social history of Manchester.
Yeah. I didn't get to know him, I must say, but you some of the trainers you mentioned there, well, Billy Graham, that's very much like, isn't it, really, the Ronnie Davis, Chris Eubank thing, Billy with Ricky Hatton.
Yeah, and you mentioned the stoppage, didn't you, with Eddie Futch and Joe Frazier. Well, Johnny Lewis, the famous and well-respected Australian trainer, did the same thing with Kostya Zou at the end of that fight, didn't he? He wouldn't let Zou out for the last round.
Looked after him. I think he knew, he knew the fight was lost, didn't he, at that point? Pulled him out. I think we've said before on previous editions of this podcast that I don't think anything much was going to stop Ricky that night, was he? And, I mean, that was a special thing. I mean, it's sad, really, the way that it all broke up, wasn't it? Between those two on the journey that they'd been together. But Billy understood Ricky Hatton like he was his soul brother.
Have you seen the documentary, the Ricky Hatton one on Sky? That's recently.
Yeah, I have, and I think it's sad. I think it's sad to watch that what was a wonderful relationship like that, how it went sour, and to see Billy in later life a little bit like that as well. Because I think we all had a lot of time for him, didn't we, John?
Yeah, I mean, people are the mental problems that Ricky's had one way or another have been very well documented because of his fame. His problems have been played out in the full glare of the national media. But I think a lot of people don't realise that Billy had a lot of depression issues and problems when he came away from boxing. His body had basically let him down. He couldn't work the pads anymore. He was getting arthritic. He was struggling in a lot of ways. But he'd been so close to Ricky when their relationship ended, whenever it was in 2008, something like that, when he walked away from boxing. I mean, it left a huge hole in Billy's life. And whenever you look back at Ricky Hatton's career, I mean, Billy played such a phenomenally important part in it. He understood Ricky in a way that no other trainer, I don't think, could have done. And certainly Floyd Mayweather Sr. didn't.
By the way, Ian, talking about we were talking about kids off the streets at Champs Camp and Moss Side a little bit ago. One of the kids off the street, as you'd say, would be Mike Tyson over in New York and Brownsville specifically. And I suppose you were there during his implosion of leaving Cuss for Kevin Rooney, or certainly from Kevin Rooney into the abyss that followed, right?
Well, I wasn't there because I was this size of the Atlantic, but certainly we were covering that story. And I mean, the thing and the question always asked was around the time, wouldn't it have been better if Mike Tyson had stayed with Kevin Rooney, you know, and who was the spin-off from Customato? But you know what? I think the answer to that question was Mike would have still gone off the rails. The story would have still gone the way that it did, because he was a wild child even then. They just kept it under wraps very well around that time, you know, when he was at Catskill. I think there were a lot of stories that got suppressed one way or another about him. So I don't think it would have changed. Would he have stayed at his peak for a longer period of time had Rooney been allowed to carry on being the trainer? Well, we'll never know, will we? We'll never know the answer to that. Maybe, possibly, but somehow his mind seemed to go away from just being this kid who was in love with boxing and knew it back to front, to a rather wilder character who started to become headline news in many other directions, put it that way.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the other guys that came from Catskill was Teddy Atlas. And he obviously, I mean, there's so many instances of Teddy inspiring fighters in the corner. You know, from taking Michael Moore's seat in between rounds to the famous We're Firemen speech with Timmy Bradley. Atlas obviously became not just a decorated trainer. I actually think he's gone in the Hall of Fame for his work as a broadcaster rather than a trainer. But sorry, Ian.
No, I was just going to say, Teddy Atlas, of course, you know, the famous speeches between the rounds in the Moore-Holyfield fight are just something incredible, aren't they? I mean, we just shut up and let him talk between the rounds, and every round we'd fade up his microphone and you'd
hear like a film script, wasn't it, Ian?
It was like a film script. I remember him saying, I think it started off at between one rounds, "Are you listening to me, Michael? Are you listening? There comes a time in a man's life when he's got to make a decision. Is he going to regret what happens next for the rest of his life? Or is he going to look back on it and think that this was his magic moment?" And like all this stuff. And every round, I mean, I'm not doing it justice. It was better than that. I'm paraphrasing it, but I've never heard a trainer's performance in the corner as good as that.
Yeah, and Teddy wasn't just a motivator. I think because of his speeches and because of people, the way they bought into him, they were disciples. And I think this is why people wanted to work with him. Tactically, he was very astute, did his homework, knew what he was up against every time. And I still hear trainers today. I asked Buddy McGirt recently, what do you think of so-and-so? I think it might have been a hell of a Dylan White fight. And he says, "I've never seen him. Just concentrating on what my guy can do." Which in some ways you kind of get and kind of respect, but also you surely, as you said at the top, you don't want to leave anything to chance. You've got to know what's coming back at you.
Well, it's like Pep Guardiola in football. I mean, he sits watching tapes of the opposition until he sees, and it jumps off the screen of him, this is the way to beat this team. This is the weakness. And I think that's exactly the same in boxing, that a boxing trainer should look at the tapes and say, this is what we're up against. Here are the mistakes he makes. This is the strategy for the fight. And then go about employing that strategy. If you've got a fighter good enough to do it, the fighter's always got to be good enough to carry out the strategy. And I guess as a trainer, this is where it gets a little bit multi-layered and a bit more complicated. You can't have a strategy that your fighter can't carry out.
Yeah, true. I mean, the thing is as well, and there's certain tells, aren't there? I mean, how many times does a fighter circle to the left as opposed to the right? You know, is he dropping his left hand when he throws his right? Is his left hand not coming back fast enough? How often does he double up the jab, and does he work the body and all the different things? Like, surely you're going to be better off going in armed with the knowledge as to what might be coming back towards you.
Well, I mean, a great one guy might be a bit of a disaster for somebody else. I mean, could you imagine Brendan Ingle training Rocky Marciano, for instance? I mean, I don't say that against Brendan, who was fantastic with the fighters that he had, but it was always based on reflexes and speed and evasiveness. So I don't think he'd been quite the right guy for Rocky Marciano, though he very much was for Harold Graham and Johnny Nelson and Naz, etc. You know,
I mean, it's worth mentioning, Brendan. We talked about some British trainers. There isn't one. And by the way, John, we need to congratulate you for being on the ballot for the International Boxing Hall of Fame, which I actually sent my ballot back last week. And
why didn't you vote for it?
For me.
No, exactly. If I crossed out Rawley's name and put yours next to it.
No,
there's still not one British trainer in the International Boxing Hall of Fame. And Brendan, I'd like to think I helped get him on the ballot a couple of years ago, but he's still not gone in. And for me, that's staggering because, John, we talk about dynasties and we talk about communities and we talk about champions. I mean, Brendan ticks every box, and to the point where, funnily enough, I was having a talk on Boxing Live Stories with Johnny Nelson relatively recently, and he was saying, oh, Usyk tries to copy what we were doing in Sheffield and all the rest of it. And I was thinking, come on, Johnny, come on, look, you know, they're doing their own thing and all the rest of it. And then I see a video where Usyk sees Johnny Nelson and he says, we've been copying Brendan Ingle's style for years, the Ukrainians. Oh. Which is amazing. So, I mean, Brendan...
That's a great story, Chris.
It is, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Brendan, how he's not got his flowers at the International Boxing Hall of Fame yet, I have no idea.
Well, what about...
I mean, he was wonderful, wasn't he?
Got into the Hall of Fame. That is a complete nonsense, because Enzo Calzaghe was voted Coach of the Year in the BBC Sports Personality of the Year Awards one year. He was the Ring Magazine Trainer of the Year as well, the American Boxing Writers Coach of the Year, because Joe went unbeaten through his career and pulled off some fantastic wins. So that is, to me, a total and utter nonsense.
Well, Goody Petronelli's not on the ballot either.
Well, for goodness sake, what? What? Marvin Hagler's trainer, give over. I'm not going to diss the Hall of Fame, but, you know, when you see something like that, you're thinking, how can that possibly be?
Yeah. Sorry, John, you were starting about Brendan there before we got Ian fired up.
A visit to that Ingle gym in Winkerbank in the east end of Sheffield back in the day used to be, I mean, it's still going now, of course, with Dominic running it. But when Brendan was in his pomp, if you like, 30 years ago or more, it was just extraordinary going there. He was 50% social worker, or maybe 75% social worker, 25% boxing trainer. And he had this style of getting all the kids up in the ring at the same time. There'd be 10 people in there sparring all at the same time. And the rule was, of course, you weren't allowed to deliver headshots. So it was concentrating all on speed, movement, reflexes, and counterpunching. And I suppose that was the style which served him so well. I think it was probably the success of Harold Graham, wasn't it, really? You know, people talk about Naz and about Johnny, but it was the Harold Graham style which evolved and which was then carried on to other fighters through the years.
He used to take Harold Graham to a local prison, and the prisoners were allowed to kind of take pot shots at Harold. If they could land a shot, they'd get a tenner or something like that. That was the deal. I mean, his other thing was to build up these kids who'd come off the streets of Sheffield and wandered in the gym with dreams of being a boxer, to build their confidence. He used to make them sing. They would sing solo songs in the gym. Do you remember that, John? I can't remember what the song was.
It was All the Colours of the Rainbow, wasn't it?
Oh, that's it. Read it. Yeah. 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 Well remembered, Chris. We're not going to do it here, though, are we?
you need Ryan Rhodes or somebody to do that for you.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, obviously, you know, you mentioned some of the names. There's also Kell Brook, Junior Witter, Kid Galahad, all world champions from that gym. Yeah. And do you know what as well? When you talk about these guys with 20 world champs, 30 world champs, a lot of these guys were in and out and had them for a couple of fights or whatever. But Brendan's guys, the Ingles had from kids. Like, they'd never thrown a punch before. They've not nicked them from anyone. They've not got them from anyone. They've not inherited them from anyone. They've brought them through from teaching them literally left from right.
What Johnny admits, I mean, he couldn't fight a lick, could he, when he started?
Yeah, well, he lost umpteen fights, didn't he, in the amateurs, and had a very ropey start in the pros.
Yeah. Became a world champion. And big
made
TV.
Umpteen defences.
Yeah.
Yeah, some great stuff.
We've been talking all this time. We haven't mentioned some very big names, have we, yet? Ray Arcel, Lou Duver, and Freddie Roach, you know, the wild card Jim.
Yeah, Freddie's been great to me over the years. I mean, I had him write a column for us at Boxing News. He did a monthly column for us, and so we were in touch a lot. And I was thinking, I actually took my kids to meet Freddie Roach in April. I was on holiday with them in California, and he welcomed me into the gym, and he gave them some merch and stuff, because we went back, because there was obviously a period of time where he was here a lot for Khan, and I was covering all the Khan fights and then covering all the Pacquiao fights. So we would meet up very, very regularly. I remember we were together having breakfast before Khan fought Peterson that morning in the hotel in Washington. And I also remember some of my best days at Boxing News really was about 2007, 2008, when Oscar had his homecoming fight against Stevie Forbes in the Home Depot Center, which, Ian, you'll know from football and the LA Galaxy.
I was at that De La Hoya Forbes fight. It wasn't very interesting.
No, it was dull. But the thing is, I sort of foresaw that was going to be a pretty quiet week and not much was going to happen. And I was pretty much right. So I spent, instead of going to Carson and spending the week down there with the traveling circus, I went and spent basically the entire week with Freddie at the wild card because everyone else was up in Carson. And he took me in and we just spent a lot of time together. There was a little Thai restaurant there where we'd go for food in the evening. And because everyone was buzzing around Carson, which is, I don't know, 10, 20 miles out of Los Angeles, it left Freddie's gym pretty deserted. And, you know, it was a great week. I was with him pretty much all day, every day, and it was fabulous. And, you know, we've sort of always got on well since. And it's interesting now because since then he's obviously had Cotto, and the Pacquiao story was just absolutely phenomenal. When you go to look at the great relationships, that's up there, isn't it, with Emmanuel and Tommy Hearns and, you know, Tyson and Rooney and Billy Graham and Hatton, you know, Pacquiao and Roach. They were just made for each other, weren't they?
Well, of course, Eddie Futch was Freddie Roach's mentor, wasn't he?
Sure.
So he learned from a master, didn't he, from the beginning. And he did it all while suffering from Parkinson's. Incredible.
Yeah, and he's still going strong today, and he's still got a stable of fighters and still highly active and all the rest of it. So John, how about some of the guys that we mentioned there? I can't ask John the Lou Duva question because of Ian's famous quote now, which has gone through Boxing Life Stories for about 200 episodes now, with Ian seeing Lou Duva in such strife during the Bogalotta riot, wasn't it?
He was a great character. He was a great character. And I mean, when he was in the corner, if the fighter wasn't a good interviewee, my goodness, Lou Duva was just brilliant. And Ian found out he was a pretty handy co-commentator as well. Frank Maloney was.
But just to retell it briefly, yeah, Frank, when the riot broke out with the the Bogalotta fight, and Frank Maloney's shouting out live on TV, "Lou Duva's dead! Lou Duva's dead!" And I had to come in and say, "I think we just need to hold it a moment there. I don't think that's going to... He's certainly been injured, but..." Oh, dear.
Oh, those God, break it.
Those were the days. Yeah, well, I think he had about 19 world champions, of course, Bernard Hopkins among them. So, yeah, I mean, he's in the conversation, as they say.
Yeah, and Bernard had that great relationship with Bowie Fischer, but that went sour as well. And I suppose it's really sad, isn't it, when you see these relationships and you see them go completely south. It is sad, isn't it, because you just remember you have such fond nostalgic memories of them being together. And when any of these splits happen, and a lot of them are about money, you know, and we get, it's this dreaded 10%, isn't it? Because 10% off 5 grand isn't the end of the world. 10% off 15 million is a big difference, right?
Well, that's the Naz Brendan Ingle thing, you know, and I don't think Prince Nassim Hamed was ever quite the same fighter after he split from Brendan Ingle.
No, he absolutely wasn't. I think he'd admit that himself.
Yeah,
I've got my dog in the background here, and she's enjoying. She's agreeing.
She agrees. She's one of the stars of the show. Keep her in the show.
Big Brendan Ingle fan. We want some sponsorship from the RSPCA.
Here's a question for you, John. Is your dog also on the ballot for the Hall of Fame? Or do you
maybe,
come?
As yeah, a pair? She could get there.
Do you come as a pair?
I've had people who've said to me when I've been commentating on various things, why don't you bring your dog with you? Could you imagine if I'm at ringside and start shouting about something happening in the fight? She'd go, and she's going bonkers. It would be interesting to say the least.
Well, there's enough freak shows going on in boxing for it to become a perfectly normal thing, I'd say.
It would be great. I can imagine Mike Goodall doing his bit to keep the peace, as he often did back in the day, grabbing a microphone and saying, "You can all shut up or I'll let John's dog off on you."
Well, she'd very happily come. She'd become a very famous pooch.
Yeah. But still, so I mean, there's obviously some great trainers around today, and you know, we've got the likes of Shane McGuigan, we've got the likes of Adam Booth, Freddie's still going around. We've got Robert Garcia in Oxnard. And obviously, like I said, you've got Papa Lomachenko and the Ukrainians. There are a lot around today. I mean, even if the sport is changing, and I suppose they have more available to them now. I mean, back in the day, a trainer used to be everything, didn't they, Ian? I mean, and now you've got strength and conditioning guys, you've got nutritionists, you've got people who do the massages, and back in the day, it was very much all under one roof, wasn't it?
Yeah, just very much a one-on-one special relationship between the trainer and the fighter. But I think you touched on it a moment ago, Tris. It always used to make me, well, chuckle, maybe not quite the right word, but when fighters got beaten in the past, what was the first thing that often happened when a good fighter got beaten? They'd sack the trainer because... Yeah. I think that was a psychological thing because the fighter, part of the psyche of being a boxer is you can't sort of come to the logic that it was you that got it wrong and you weren't good enough. So the easy opt-out is to say, I need another trainer. I got the wrong information. It was the wrong strategy. The relationship doesn't seem the same anymore. So you see that time and time again, that a fighter, when he loses a fight, or, you know, a good fighter with a fairly lengthy unbeaten record loses, and they're looking for another trainer, which is a little bit sad.
Robert McCracken was on the receiving end of that, wasn't he, with AJ? You know, he brought him through the amateurs, he'd taken him all the way, and then he has the setback, has an unexpected loss, and they're looking for an excuse, so out went Robert. And I thought, I did feel for him a little bit in that situation.
Excellent trainer, Robert, excellent trainer, one of the best that we've got, and one of the best that we've had, for sure. And I think then AJ had one fight with Robert Garcia, didn't he, before joining with Derek James. So it's interesting to see how fighters move and if they don't move. And in fact, I had a very interesting conversation with Adam Booth this week about just to catch up, really. And we were talking about Michael Conlon, who's now moved to train with Pedro Diaz in Florida after two knockout losses in two world title attempts with Adam. And they've had a very amicable split. And I suppose this is the thing where I was going with this, Ian, is sometimes ego does get in the way. And it really hasn't with Adam, because Adam said, well, look, we've had two runs at the world title. He's got stopped in both times. And I don't really want to be part of any residual psychological baggage for him for having a third ring walk, thinking, well, I've got knocked out with this guy behind me twice. You know, what's going to happen now? And I think he's you know, Conlon's gone for a new, what would you say, a new coat of paint in Florida. And when he does approach the ring for a world title fight, if he gets one again, it will be Emperor's New Clothes, even if it helps psychologically a small bit. And that sounds like the way it should be in terms of, you know, being gracious and amicable and that kind of stuff.
I guess that, you know, with some relationships, they do come to a natural end. And it is the right thing. So, yeah, if both people agree that it's the right thing, which seems to be the case there, well, happy day. So often it isn't that way, is it?
No, it's bad. And, you know, then the lawyers are involved and all the rest of it. And it can get very, very ugly. And some of the worst things we've seen have been these a trainer and a fighter blow ups. And, you know, the Tyson Rooney one was very expensive business in court at the time. There's been all sorts, but still, is there anyone that you think we haven't mentioned? I mean, I know there's countless, you know, there's Joe Goosen. Obviously we only name check Goody Petronelli.
Let's give a name check to Brian Hughes, who was kind of like Manchester, wasn't he, of Brendan, all the community and social work he did apart from producing champion fighters like, you know, Robin Reed and a few others.
Well, yeah. And then again, I think you can tell the impact of these guys by the amount of disciples they have that want to do the same thing and help people. And when you look at Brian Hughes, Robin Reed is training fighters, Pat Barrett is training fighters, Tommy McDonough is training fighters. They've left such an imprint on these young men and been so influential that they've not only want these guys to follow or got these guys to follow in their footsteps, but they've also got these guys on the straight and narrow and kept them on the straight and narrow.
Well, Brian was great. He used to tell me stories about, like, the Busby Babes, you know, before the Munich air disaster. He used to come down, you know, around the gym. Brian Kidd and Nobby Stiles used to come down and spar at his gym. Can you imagine modern footballers being allowed to do that? Getting the gloves on and having a bit of a box in the ring.
Curtis Woodhouse, he was the one who used to do that. He used to turn up to training at Bramall Lane when Neil Warnock was there. And Warnock was sort of saying, what have you been up to? What's you been doing with your social life? He'd come in with black eyes and God knows what. And Curtis would have to spin some sort of a yarn and make a lie about it. But in fact, he was going down and working out and he was training. And ultimately, he showed that he was pretty damn good at it as well. Good enough to be a British champion.
Well, he gave up professional football, didn't he, for boxing?
You know, I know this is nothing to do. Well, I suppose it's a little bit about training because it's about what sort of shape you're in for a fight. He was a champion at 9 stone 9 and at 10 stone. You know, he was anything between lightweight and welterweight, Curtis Woodhouse. And he said that when he was playing First Division Premier League top class football, he said he was walking around at 12 stone. That's the difference between football fitness and boxing fitness.
Wow, that's terrifying. That's terrifying, but very interesting. Great stat. Great stat, John. Done well with that. Right, gents, I think we'll call it there, but this has been an enjoyable John. We might revisit this with some of the names that we haven't talked about or go deeper on.
We're going to get bombarded, aren't we? I think we have to add the rider here with apologies to the many good trainers that we haven't given a mention to here, and I'm sure we must have missed a couple out somewhere.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, we haven't even really touched on Peter Harrison, who had that great run with Scott Harrison and did work with Alex Arthur. There's countless others. We've not mentioned Mark Tibbs. There's a lot of different rabbit holes
Ray
we can
Arcel.
Go down.
Ray Arcel. Talking about him, you know, he was around 1920s to 1980s, you know, going back to Benny Leonard and all the way through to Duran and Holmes. So, you know, that's another one. So you're right. There's another edition in this somewhere.
Yeah. Sure. Well, gents, it's been an absolute pleasure. Always, always good to speak to you. And thank you very much for your time. Guys, we'll be back with Ringside Rewind soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.